or that heavy hammer, as long as through the preview and review from the AG's office, prior to going to court, the AG's office, in accordance with this particular proposed law, would review the case and say, these folks operated in good faith, they complied with the law, everything's hunky-dory. Or in fact, at least that's my intention in this bill, the AG's office could say, no, it doesn't look like the arbitration process was done in good faith or complied with, and therefore you have a recourse of going to court. I think you're putting and I shared this with you too on a one-on-one, but I want it as a matter of public record. You're putting out the big boogeyman out there, implying, the implication is there in what you're stating, that in every case folks are going to go to court and they're just going to tiptoe through the arbitration process, and some shark attorney is going to say, hey, you know, just roll through this process, let's go to court and we'll get triple the damages. And I guess I would submit to you that in those cases where this option of going to court was utilized, there are some sharks out there, but I'm not so sure that there are so many sharks out there that you've got really a problem of major concern.
The consumer has never been denied the option of going to court. And the way the programs are established now, the manufacturer voluntarily has to comply with the decision of the arbitration board. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a problem with that whatsoever. But we feel obviously that the case should be decided on its merits, and I think that there's provisions in the existing law that if there's any violations or gross misrepresentations in the law, there's presently provisions to allow the court to make an adequate and equitable decision in that regard.
I guess my personal comment, and we'll move on, is that your folks have just, I don't believe they've approached this law in a reasonable fashion, and they've done a very poor job, to put it mildly, in taking care of their consuming public. And as a personal opinion, the more you do to take care of that consuming public out there, the better and more business you're going to do. Any further comments or questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Jim, do you have any amendments or proposals or amendments?
Sure does.
There were two amendments that were asked to be considered by the committee, that being in Section 5, where the attorney's fees should be go to the prevailing party, and then the elimination of the punitive damages.
Thank you. And again, remember, I like you as a fellow and a gentleman. Always remember that.
We had a good conversation in your office.
Yes, we did. Let's ask David Slater from Justice Department to come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Slater, Chief Counsel, Business Legal and Consumer Affairs, the Attorney General's Office. The Attorney General is a strong supporter of the concept of the Lemon Law, has consistently been a supporter, and we support the principle of toughening up the law. Our handicap at this time is that we can't tell you much about how the Lemon Law works. We really don't know. It is probably the most important piece of consumer legislation on the books in Oregon and most other states, but we have no role in it. It goes on totally independent of anything that our financial fraud section does. We receive many complaints, but we have to turn them away because they don't involve violations of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. They are simply warranty complaints. We refer people back to the dealers and to the manufacturer. We perform an education function to teach the public about how the lemon law works, but we can't tell you whether it works. We are be very glad to have the authority that is in the C-1 that would allow us to request from any arbitration and mediation service used by a manufacturer the results of their work. We would not, Madam Chair, members of the committee, not like to be a repository or a court of appeals, in effect, for each arbitration or mediation proceeding that would have major program and fiscal impact on us. But we want to be able to do, for example, what Connecticut did, and I can leave a copy of this with you. The Connecticut Attorney General's Office did a study, a very detailed study, of how arbitration proceedings were working under their lemon law. They concluded that they were not working, that not a single arbitration procedure set up by a manufacturer was in substantial compliance with Magnuson-Moss. Those guidelines, and they had serious problems with getting information from the manufacturers and the arbitration processes. So we would like our role to be that in the amended bill rather, Madam Chair, than the original version of the Osberg bill, because I don't think we have the resources or are about to get the resources to act as a court of appeals in every arbitration proceeding.
One thing, if I may interject, too, just food for thought for this committee. One of the neat things that we as a committee have passed through the process already, and I encourage you, by the way, to further participate in that process. You might recall a little committee bill that we introduced that would allow for an interim study and possibly potentially setting up an arbitration board. And I know that the AG's office has a strong interest in that, and so do a lot of other folks. And, you know, ultimately, to carry this lemon law through and many other laws that we have in the state, that may be a real asset to have. Just throwing out food for thought.
Madam Chair, the short response would be that lemon law, if it works, could be a model for the arbitration of private disputes and keeping them out of the court system. We'd like to see that.
Well, I'd ultimately like to see that, too. But sometimes you have to put a little hammer at the top of the door and say, this could drop on you. So be good and do your best work. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Christine Chatwood? Better Business Bureau. Pardon my naivety. Are you housed in Portland?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I've had so many people, and I finally found out that most of what you do, if you're looking at different places in the state, goes through the AG's office, Consumer Protection.
Right.
But at one time, way before I got involved in this process, I thought we had a state Better Business Bureau. But I guess we have never had that.
No, actually, the only Better Business Bureau office in the state of Oregon is located in Portland. And with the exception of the AutoLine program, which we service statewide, we only service the Tri-County area and Clark County, Washington, so the Portland metropolitan area.
I need you to be sure to introduce yourself
formally
to us.
Sure. I'm Christine Chatwood, and I'm the Director of Dispute Settlement for the Better Business Bureau here in Oregon. I think you've all gotten the packets. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to come and talk with you a bit about the Better Business Bureau's AutoLine program. I think it's important for the members of the committee to understand that sort of like the stars in the sky and the snowflakes, not all arbitration programs are alike. And we'd just like to take the opportunity to give you some information about how the Better Business Bureau AutoLine program works, make a few comments on some areas of the proposed legislation, and then obviously answer any questions that you have about our program. I've given you in your packet a little lengthy outline or narrative on how the steps of the program go, and I'll just sort of highlight that.
May I ask you a quick question?
Certainly.
I may have missed it initially in your beginning testimony. Do you support or oppose this particular piece of legislation?
The Better Business Bureau doesn't take a
stand
either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's probably politically wise.
Well, we're a private nonprofit organization, and we exist to serve both business and consumers. And our goal really is to protect consumers through promoting ethical business practices and monitoring business practices in the private sector. And that's why we started 75 years ago. And in Oregon, and we're the oldest bureaus in the country, we were chartered in 1916.
Good grief.
So what you have in your packets are two brochures, first of all. The TAM brochure, which discusses the entire mediation arbitration program. And our program is a two-pronged approach to settling disputes. The first approach is mediation, where one of our trained staff mediators works with the customer and the factory, the manufacturer's representative, to attempt to work out a resolution to the problem that they both feel comfortable with. The vast majority of the cases that we handle are settled at that stage. The second, the green one, oh, and by the way, this brown pamphlet is sent to every consumer when they first call us and say, I want to go through your program, because we feel it's important that they have as much information as possible about the program so that they can prepare for it, they know what to expect. If nothing else, they then know what they don't know and can call us up and ask us questions. The green pamphlet outlines the rules for arbitration. These are the procedural rules that apply to any auto line arbitration nationwide. You also have a sheet of paper that sets out the exposure limits for every manufacturer who participates in BBB auto line. Every manufacturer has pre-committed contractually with the Council of Better Business Bureaus to resolve their consumer complaints as long as the customer owns the vehicle up to the limits laid out on this sheet of paper. And you'll notice that even the most minimum voluntary exposure for what's called a buyback proceeding, where the customer wants their car repurchased or replaced, is 24 months, 24,000 miles for any of the manufacturers who participate in our program. Okay. You also have a blank copy of an agreement to arbitrate, and this is the document that both the customer and the company sign that outlines what each of them views the nature of the dispute to be and the remedy that each of them is seeking from the arbitrator. And they both sign it, and then this document outlines the scope of the arbitrator's authority. For instance, if a customer comes seeking a repurchase of their vehicle for the cash purchase price of $12,500, then the maximum amount the arbitrator can award is $12,500. It just sets the limit so everyone knows what the game is. On the other side, you have obviously a little written testimony. Then you have two cover letters that we send out to the customer when we send out the initial complaint form, outlining for them the documents that they need to send back to us and giving them yet more information on the program. That's followed by two memos that we send to the customer if they don't send their complaint form back. For instance, we would send a customer a complaint form on April 1st. If we had not received anything back in 10 days, we would send them a memo reminding them that we needed the information from them before we could do anything. Another 10 days, send them a second memo asking them to get in contact with us and let us know if they want to pursue it or what the status is. And 10 days after that, finally, we give them a phone call to see if they really don't want to pursue this program or if they simply have lost their form or misplaced it or they've moved or something and they need us to send them another one. And it's only after that point that we close the case if they don't respond. The last form that you get is a copy of what we call the ACR, which is a 5-ply sheet that is the complaint form. The page number one is the form that is sent to the consumer, along with the cover letter and the brown pamphlet, when they call us and say that they wish to open a case. And then the other forms get moved through the system at a different point in time, many of them eventually ending up at our national office being key punched into the computer. And it is speculated that considering our caseload, we probably eliminate half a national forest a year in paper through this program. basically, our program is run by the Better Business Bureau. The procedures and the policies are all established by the Council of Better Business Bureaus, which is located in Arlington, Virginia, and the program is administered through 168 different Better Business Bureaus throughout the country. There is at least one Better Business Bureau in every state in the union. We operate a little differently than many of the other arbitration programs that you've heard about. Some of the key features that make us different are, one, that our arbitrators, who are all volunteers who are trained by the Better Business Bureau to arbitrate consumer complaint cases, whether they're automotive cases or dry cleaning cases or home remodeling cases or whatever they are, they're all volunteers who serve without any financial compensation whatsoever. Just about the only thing we do for them is if they travel out of town, which ours often do since we service the whole state of Oregon, we reimburse them for their expenses. The other thing that is an integral part of our arbitration process is that while a consumer is free to choose to have their arbitration hearing either in person, by phone, or in writing, almost all cases are done in person. And in fact, we urge customers to present their cases in person to the arbitrator. It's our feeling that it is much easier for someone to talk face-to-face with the person who's making the decision, to be there to answer their questions, than it is for them to try to anticipate every possible question and make sure it's in their written testimony that then gets submitted. So very rarely do we have written arbitrations, and only then when that is the wish of the consumer. And in cases where the customer is either requesting a repair for a current problem or requesting a repurchase or replacement, it's also a requirement that the arbitrator, in the presence of the consumer and the company's representative, inspect the vehicle and test drive it so that there's an opportunity for that arbitrator to experience any current problem that's being alleged. The arbitrator is the person who conducts the hearing. Essentially, once all of the parties have signed the agreements to arbitrate, they are sent a list of potential arbitrators. We give them the name and a biographical paragraph about each arbitrator. Both the company and the customer are asked to cross off anyone that they know professionally or personally. We feel it's important that the arbitrator not know either party to the arbitration, that there not be anything that could possibly color their decision. We get those back, and the arbitrator who has the highest overlapping ranking and is available is the person who hears the case. Better Business Bureau staff then schedules a hearing at a time that all the parties can be there, either in Portland. We basically will go just about anywhere in the state that we can fly an arbitrator into and out of in a day. Since our arbitrators are volunteers and many of them take vacation time if they're going to do out-of-town arbitrations, we try to make sure that they only have to take one day. So we do arbitrations for the most part in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, Pendleton, and Bend. So we want to make it as accessible to the customer as possible, but we are limited pretty much by that time frame. Did you have a question?
Okay. No.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative McTeague.
The Osberg testimony indicated that the Better Business Bureau program fell within the federal Magnus and Moss guidelines. Is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, Representative McTeague, it is my understanding that we have structured the program to the best of our knowledge to have it substantially comply with Rule 703. It's also my understanding that while the Federal Trade Commission staff has agreed that, yes, we seem to meet most of the requirements of that, they've been reluctant to say that any program nationally is indeed 703 certified. We've been asking them for years to either tell us that we comply with all the provisions of 703 or else tell us what we have to do in order to comply, and have not yet gotten that information. I would suspect that with the negotiated rulemaking on 703 that's going on nationally, that it'll be some time before those decisions are made by the Federal Trade Commission. So anyway, we set up the hearing. Both parties present their cases in person to the arbitrator, have a chance to ask each other questions, a chance to review all the evidence that the other side is presenting. The arbitrator closes the case and within 10 days, renders a written decision, which is then sent to both parties. The customer, of course, having the option to either reject or accept that decision. and their acceptance binding the company to comply. And that's briefly how our program runs. A couple of concerns we have about the proposed legislation. In talking with our national office, our staff attorney in Arlington, and a couple of other Better Business Bureau presidents around the country, we're concerned about the wording that would include leased vehicles. It's not that we think leased vehicles shouldn't be included, but it is the feeling of the people that I've talked to that the current wording would, in essence, create a situation where a consumer with a leased vehicle could win an arbitration and still have to pay a substantial amount of money out of pocket. And that is because of the early termination costs on a lease, which include finance charges. I know that they've been grappling with it in Minnesota. I just talked with the president of the Minnesota Bureau yesterday, and the attorney general there and the legislature and the BBB people have been trying to come up with some wording that would meet the needs of the consumers and the manufacturers and at the same time also meet the needs of the leasing companies. And if it would please the committee, I can certainly get copies of that proposed legislation and send it on to you.
Would very much appreciate it.
It seems to be the best wording anyone's come up with nationally. The other concern that we have has to do with reporting to the Department of Justice. We're concerned about a couple of things. One of the things is that the way the bill currently reads, it doesn't make clear what it is that needs to be turned over. It doesn't make clear also what's going to happen to that information. One of the reasons traditionally that people, whoever they are, whether they're going to mediation or arbitration for a consumer dispute, they're going to divorce mediation, they're going to, you know, neighbor-to-neighbor mediation, whatever they're doing, has been the fact that those proceedings are confidential, that they're in a position to be more open and possibly more vulnerable than they would be in court or in a more public forum where the proceedings become a matter of public record. We're concerned that that concern of people who choose to participate doesn't get lost in, you know, searching for a greater good and thereby discourage people from using this process. So we'd be concerned about what the Department of Justice was going to do with those records. Were they going to publish them? Were they just going to hang on to them to review? Were they going to send them back to us after someone in the Department of Justice had looked at them? Just some of the concerns that we have been wondering about because of this specific
statement. I think that your concern is certainly well taken, but I don't think that their role will be quite as awesome as maybe the road you're traveling on. Representative Gilman, did you have a comment?
Numbers. I'm just curious, how many disputes did you settle in 1986?
Well, I can tell you. It's actually in here. In 1986, nationally, in the AutoLine program, we closed a total of 136,065 automotive cases. Of that total, 21,892 were settled through arbitration in the regular program. The regular program excludes, for instance, the Federal Trade Commission consent order on the three specified components with GM. That's a whole different set of statistics, which I haven't yet gotten from our national office. In Oregon, in regular program, we closed 2,049 cases, and of that total, 225 were resolved in arbitration. Now, that includes not only people who came through seeking repurchase or replacement, but people who came through seeking reimbursement for past repairs, seeking to have current problems repaired at no expense to themselves, all of those things. Our national computer was not able to give me a breakdown of all of those different categories.
So this is not,
Please continue.
This is not just new cars that were lemons in.
This is everything. I mean, for instance, with General Motors, a customer can arbitrate for repurchase of their vehicle based on a powertrain problem, an engine or transmission problem, for the life of the car. We've had people come through requesting repurchases at 70 or 80,000 miles. They can request repair of items with some manufacturers up to 5 years or 50,000 miles, with others up to 3 years or 36,000 miles. So it includes the whole gamut.
Thank you very much for coming.
Just a couple of more I'll be really quick about it.
Move along.
Okay. On the reporting, the other things that we would need clarified if this is going to be part of the law are just what parts of the case files they would want. Currently, we don't do transcripts of hearings because of the expense. We have a staff person there to answer policy questions and procedure questions. But if it's going to be a review of the whole case, would that mean then that we would be required to make transcripts of all hearings, to do audio tapes of all hearings, mm-hmm. That kind of thing, and we're concerned about then the accumulated cost of that.
Thank you very much. Finally, Carla Zelensky. Pretty good, huh?
Good afternoon. I'm Carla Zelensky, and I am a consumer currently living here in Salem. And what I'm going to do this afternoon, I am going to read my testimony so that I can stay on track, and simply because it was a story that happened to me starting last year. And attached to my testimony, you will find a copy of letter of response from Subaru America, also a copy of a letter I received from Jim Brown after we closed and I traded off my vehicle of December 31st of 1986. And then also, I have enclosed two pages of resources of individuals that I had contacted over the 11-month period of time trying to resolve my legal lemon. For 7 years, I had been the owner of a Subaru sedan, which I had purchased used. The car had proven to be so reliable that when I purchased a new car, I selected another Subaru. On January 31st, 1986, I purchased a 1986 GL 4x4 station wagon for $9,184 from Brown Oldsmobile Subaru in Portland, Oregon. This purchase was my first acquaintance with this dealership. On February 11th of 1986, at 956 miles, the car was taken into the dealership for installation of an air conditioner and repair of the center brake light, a repair which I considered normal and which was covered by warranty. As a footnote, I want you to imagine as you are getting into my car, because you are a consumer, how you can visualize that we are driving down I-5 and what happened on March 11th of 1986 at 3,515 miles. While driving on Interstate 5, going to work, I heard a loud clanking pop and smoke and steam came from under the hood and out of the exhaust and obstructed my vision. Although I had no visibility and was in the middle lane, I was able to pull the car to the side of the freeway without injuring myself or any other motorist. The car stopped and could not be restarted. I had it towed to Brown Oldsmobile Subaru. John Baker, service manager, indicated that the internal parts of the engine had broken through the engine block. Since the engine needed to be replaced, the dealership loaned me a 1986 XT Turbo. After 3 weeks, I had to return this loaner car because its exhaust system had to be replaced. The service department then loaned me another 1986 car. Under ORS 646.315-646.375, my car should have qualified as a legal lemon. The current law states that a total of 30 business days or 4 attempts to repair the car on any defect will qualify for replacement of the vehicle. My car was in the shop for 36 business days the first time and a total of 54 business days. The day I traded the car off, it still had a choke problem, which had never been corrected. Subaru America does not participate with AutoCAP or the Better Business Bureau Arbitration Board, and they do not have their own formal arbitration process. Since I did not have an objective third party to review my case, I've had to work as a partner with my dealership. I have contacted over 17 individual resources for advice on resolving a legal lemon. See attached resource list. On May 6, 1986 at 4,216 miles while driving down Interstate 5 to work, I saw the temperature indicator was running into the red zone. I had Don Cohen of Bob Brown Subaru inspect the car's air cooling system, and comparing the car with another 1986 Subaru, he advised me that a slightly red temperature indicator was normal for this model car. On May 12, 1986, at 4,827 miles, when I took the car in for its 1,000-mile checkup for the new engine after the block replacement, I spent $19 for fluids which had to be replaced. Because the car was still starting cold and lugging at 50 to 55 miles, Cole and I discussed again the temperature indicator being in the red zone. The service team made adjustments to correct the starting and lugging problems, but continued to think the temperature was normal. I suspected there was a problem with the car's temperature. On May 19, 1986, at 5,439 miles, while I drove home on Interstate 5, the car overheated. The temperature gauge rose to the top of the heat zone and beyond. I called Bob Brown Subaru and was advised.